The headlines: Lebanon forms a new government after being run by a caretaker government for over a year. Israeli soldiers injure dozens of Palestinians during protests across the occupied territories in solidarity with their fellow Palestinians held in Israeli prisons. And the number of coronavirus cases and deaths keeps declining in Iran as the government accelerates vaccinations across the country. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour: Lebanon has announced the formation of a new government under Najib Mirati in an attempt to put an end to the country's months-long political deadlock. Lebanon's President Michel Aoun and Prime Minister-designate Najib Mirati officially signed the decree to form the new government on Friday. The presidency said in a statement that the decree was signed in the presence of Parliament Speaker Nabi Berri. The new cabinet consists of 24 members. Walid Fayyad has been designated Energy and Water Minister, while Mori Selim will take the helm of the Defense Ministry. Mirati was tasked with forming a new government in July. Lebanon has been run by a caretaker administration led by Hassan Diab since last August. The country is grappling with a deep financial crisis worsened by a political deadlock. The Israeli army has made more arrests over the Monday jail break of six Palestinians from a high-security prison of the regime. Two brothers and a sister of suspected mastermind Mahmoud Arda were detained near the city of Jenin in the northern West Bank. Other relatives of the six fugitives, all from the Jenin area, were arrested on Wednesday. They are now all in detention. A massive manhunt is also underway in the occupied territories. The six Palestinians escaped from Gilboa prison through a tunnel dug beneath a sink in a cell. Israel has decided to relocate inmates following the jailbreak. Israeli forces have injured dozens of Palestinians during protests across the occupied territories in solidarity with their fellow Palestinians held in Israeli prisons. The regime forces attacked protesters in Beita near the city of Nablus using rubber bullets and tear gas. Palestinians in Al-Quds gathered at Al-Aqsa Mosque condemning the regime's repression inside prisons. Similar protests were also held in the town of Araba near Jenin. People in the besieged Gaza Strip also offered Friday prayers in front of the Red Cross headquarters to express their support for Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. Palestinian resistance factions had called for a day of rage on Friday against Israel's decision to relocate inmates. Israel is using heavy-handed tactics against inmates and their families since six Palestinians escaped from the regime's high-security prison. Our correspondent Mona Kandil is joining us now from Ramallah. Mona, welcome to the program. Talk to us more about the Israeli forces' heavy-handed tactics against Palestinians in the West Bank following the jailbreak from the Israeli Gilboa prison.
Well, Palestinians took to the streets following the Friday prayers in several areas in the occupied West Bank. In the first place, to send a message that they will do their utmost to protect those six Palestinian prisoners who succeeded to get out from Gilboa prison last Monday, as well as to support the Palestinian prisoners calling for an end of the Israeli military legal measures against thousands of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails, because the Israeli guards are punishing the Palestinian prisoners for what the six other prisoners had done. Demonstrations took place. Let's speak about a protest in the village of Beita near Nablus, as well as Beit Dajan also in Nablus. At least 40 Palestinians were wounded during these two demonstrations, where the Israeli forces fired heavy tear gas, stun grenades, as well as rubber-coated bullets to disperse the protesters, also injuring a Palestinian journalist who was there, shooting him in the chest. In Beit Umar town, in Al-Khalil, also known as Hebron, southern, the occupied West Bank, Palestinians have also protested following the Friday prayers, and the clashes took place between the Palestinian youths and the Israeli forces in Al-Khalil. Elsewhere, Palestinian factions, the Islamic and national powers, have called for Friday to be a day of rage. However, such protests have taken place, but there are calls for night, maybe, demonstrations. However, family members of those six Palestinians who succeeded to get out of Gilboa prison, many of them had been arrested by the Israeli forces. Today, some were released, but the Israeli authorities informed them that they are not allowed to speak to the journalists, they are not allowed to receive guests or any form of celebrations, and if they hold, hold any kind of celebrations or any form of celebrations, they would be again arrested. The Israeli regime also warned family members of the six Palestinian prisoners that they must inform the Israeli regime of anything they know about their family members. However, they would be or they would be arrested by the Israeli regime.
All right, thanks a lot. Mona Kandil joining us from Ramallah.
Hello and welcome to a special news segment coming to you live from Afghanistan's capital, Kabul. My name is Amin Alemi. Concerns are mounting over the humanitarian situation in Afghanistan as funds remain frozen in the wake of the Taliban takeover of the country. The UN has warned of an economic collapse here. It says the world has a duty to extend solidarity to Afghanistan, where millions risk dying of hunger.
Fears are growing over the humanitarian situation in Afghanistan, where a new government is being formed under the Taliban rule, a group not yet recognized by the international community. The UN chief has called for maintaining a dialogue with the Taliban to avoid an economic collapse he says could lead to millions of deaths.
Naturally, the Taliban want to be recognized. They want the sanctions to be lifted. They want financial support, and this gives the international community some leverage. I think that naturally we don't have an internationally recognized government yet, but I also think that we have to avoid an economic collapse situation, which could create appalling humanitarian consequences for the Afghan people.
The UN Special Envoy for Afghanistan has also warned of humanitarian impacts if funds remain frozen in the aftermath of the Taliban takeover of the country.
Assets and dollar and donor funds have been frozen by members of the international community. The understandable purpose is to deny these funds to the de facto Taliban administration. The inevitable effect, however, will be a severe economic downturn that could throw many more millions into poverty and hunger, may generate a massive wave of refugees from Afghanistan, and indeed set Afghanistan back for generations.
Afghanistan's neighbors are also worried about the humanitarian situation there. Iran's permanent representative to the UN says Afghanistan's dire situation is a direct result of the 20-year U.S. war there.
Hundreds of thousands of Afghans have fled their country. Nearly 600,000 of others have become internally displaced. Essential food supplies are running short, and 18.4 million people need humanitarian assistance. This situation is primarily the direct result of the intervention by the United States and other foreign forces in Afghanistan and their irresponsible withdrawal.
The U.S. fully withdrew from Afghanistan by August 31st, 2 weeks after the Taliban swept to power. The pullout ended the U.S. military presence criticized for failing to restore peace in Afghanistan. Washington is now facing calls by humanitarian groups to unfreeze funds parked in the U.S. as part of sanctions against the Taliban. Food and fuel prices are already soaring in Afghanistan amid a shortage of cash, partly triggered by the U.S. halt in dollar shipments. Aid groups say the cost of economically pressuring the new Afghan rulers is the lives of millions of ordinary people already bearing the brunt of 20 years of U.S. occupation.
The United States has praised the Taliban for facilitating the first evacuation of Americans from Afghanistan after the U.S. withdrew. The White House said the departure from Kabul to Doha on chartered Qatar Airways flight marked a positive first step with the new government. It said the Taliban have been cooperative and businesslike and shown flexibility in the matter. Nearly 40 U.S. citizens or permanent residents were invited to board the Thursday flight, but only 21 were on board. The United States had previously said a little more than 100 Americans remained in Afghanistan after Washington fully withdrew on August 31st. A U.S. media poll says many Americans believe that events after September 11, 2001 had a more negative than a positive impact on the country. According to the survey conducted by Washington Post and ABC News, 46% of the people say the events of 9/11 changed the country for the worse, while 33% believe they changed the country for the better. That represents a large swing from the first anniversary of the attack in 2002. Back then, 55% said the country had changed for the better. Nearly 3,000 people were killed on 9/11, when hijacked airplanes smashed into the World Trade Center towers in New York. 15 of the 19 hijacks were Saudi citizens. Political analyst Leon Williams says the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan following the 9/11 attacks was a disproportionate. Let's listen to what he has to say.
The reaction in Afghanistan was completely disproportionate. The small group of people who conducted these raids were, as you pointed out, more closely related to the Saudis than to the Afghans. And when the army did go in there into Afghanistan, which allegedly was the cause and the root of the terrorists, they didn't go with huge armies. They used mercenaries. They used warlords. They used people. Well, they were used war criminals, basically. And they were paid for from CIA funds to get rid of the Taliban, while the main military force and money was spent in Iraq, which was completely unrelated. I mean, what could go wrong by hitting the wrong target with the wrong forces while, you know, and ignoring the real target?
Well, that's it from me here in Kabul. Now, let's go back to Badia Honardar in Tehran for the rest of the news.
Thanks a lot. I mean, that was very old man, out in the Afghan capital, Kabul. We're going to return now to our top story for the program, where Lebanon has announced the formation of a new government under Najib Mirattin in an attempt to put an end to the country's months-long political deadlock. Our correspondent, Mariam Saleh, is joining us now from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Mariam, what are some of the immediate challenges in store for a new government in Lebanon?
Well, the challenges are many. We're talking about economic, financial, monetary, social, even now security challenges that this government is facing in light of the crisis that people are living through. Prime Minister Najib Mikati has stressed that he will try to deal with all these issues. But the formation of the cabinet itself is something that is positive. It is one of the first steps that we needed to take. We saw how it was encouraged by most of the political factions, even by foreign groups. We saw the French pushing for a government very strongly, even trying to get acceptance from or getting approval and support from the Americans. The Americans had seemed to have vetoed such a cabinet. However, with the what seems to be a really dire situation where there's no fuel, no electricity, no medicine, and we saw with Hezbollah's initiative of bringing in fuel from the Islamic Republic of Iran, we saw that change in the international, the Western method in Lebanon and how they helped or pushed for this cabinet. And at the same time, there were issues that were tied inside the country with issues related to, of course, for example, the sectarian balance in the cabinet, which is part of the national charter, and the fact that this needed all the ministers need approval from the factions that are The strongest in the parliament, we're talking about the faction that is mostly supportive of President Michel Aoun, Hezbollah, the Yamma movement, and their allies, and also have the major groups like the Future Movement and the former prime ministers, the friends, if we may say, of former Prime Minister Saad Hariri and Fouad Sinoura. So they also had a say. We had some other groups that were blocking, that were pushing for a new parliamentary elections. However, this did not happen because as long as the term of the president continues, then therefore there needs to be a cabinet. This cabinet is supposed to serve for around 8 months, so therefore it does not have enough time to really put in long-term solutions or long-term objectives. What it can do is try to solve or fill in the gaps of the things that it can do quickly, some quick fixes here and there, some solutions, perhaps bringing in more funds from the International Monetary Fund. As you know, these were stalled after the resignation of the Hassan Diab government. So therefore, you have issues that are in the drawer that can be done real quickly. You also have issues that were already prepared by the previous cabinet, concerning, for example, the ration card or the social welfare card for those families that are in dire need, that are in below the poverty line. So that needs to be some of the first few things that this government implements in order to try to stop this collapse. And this is what we heard from Prime Minister Najib Mikati. He said, we'll work with all our heart. We'll work together as I cooperated with President Michel Aoun on forming this cabinet. I will work with my team. And he stressed that this is not just a sectarianly divided cabinet. This is a team. We will work as one to try to lower the sufferings of the people. We saw a very emotional speech, actually, for Prime Minister Najib Mikati after the cabinet was formed. He said how parents cannot provide medication for their children who are ill. They cannot pay for the tuition for their for their children's schools, and now they cannot even take their kids to school because of lack of fuel.
All right, thanks a lot, Mayim. We're going to leave it there. That was our correspondent, Mayim Saleh, joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Elsewhere, the number of coronavirus cases and deaths is declining in Iran as the government accelerates vaccinations across the country. Iran's health ministry reported some 21,000 new cases in the past 24 hours until Friday. The ministry also said that 445 more people died in the same time, bringing the total fatalities in the country to over 113,000. The vaccination drive in the country is also gathering pace as more than 30 million doses of vaccines have been injected so far. More than 240 towns and cities across the nation are currently categorized as very high-risk locations in terms of the coronavirus infection. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
Airstrikes conducted by the United States have killed between 22,000 and 48,000 civilians since September 11, 2001, according to a report published recently by Air Wars, a military watchdog that monitors and seeks to reduce civilian harm in violent conflict zones. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Kenny Stansil Ryder. This article is published under the heading, U.S. airstrikes have killed up to 48,000 civilians since 9/11, analysis says. Stay tuned for more. Airstrikes conducted by the United States have killed between 22,000 and 48,000 civilians since September 11, 2001, according to a report published recently by Air Wars, a military watchdog that monitors and seeks to reduce civilian harm in violent conflict zones. The new analysis released ahead of the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 terrorist attacks and the retaliatory launch of the so-called War on Terror came just days after a U.S. drone strike killed at least 10 members of a single family in Kabul amid the withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan. Most media accounts point out that more than 7,000 U.S. service members have died in post-9/11 wars, but only some go on to state the massive civilian death toll, and almost exclusively in generalities, researchers lamented. While Brown University's Cost of War project estimates that over 387,000 civilians have been killed as a result of the so-called War on Terror, Air War sought to answer a specific question. How many civilians have likely been killed by U.S. airstrikes in the last 20 years? The answer Air Wars found is at least 22,679 and potentially as many 48,308 civilians. Acknowledging the imprecision of their estimate, the group noted that the gap between these two figures reflects the many unknowns when it comes to civilian harm in war. Belligerents rarely track the effects of their own actions, and even then do so poorly, researchers wrote. It is left to local communities, civil society, and international agencies to count the cost. The Pentagon has declared a minimum of 91,340 airstrikes in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Pakistan, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen. Seven countries the U.S. military invaded or assaulted with bombs or drones in the past 20 years. Notable peaks occurred during the 2003 invasion of Iraq between 2015 and 2017, the height of the military offensive against ISIS in Iraq, Syria, and Libya. Given the dubious nature of data supplied by the U.S. military, which notoriously undercounts civilian fatalities, Air Wars gathered together every reliable assessment of direct civilian harm caused by U.S. actions to construct a data set that includes information from the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, Iraq Body Count, The Nation, the United Nations Assistance Mission in Afghanistan, and their own previous studies. Wherever possible, we sought to measure civilian harm just from U.S. airstrikes, but in some cases, such as the first years of the Iraq invasion, it was impossible to disaggregate airstrikes from artillery fire and other heavy munitions which were therefore included, researchers noted. Likewise, in some U.S.-led coalitions, it was impossible to determine whether each individual strike was American, though U.S. air power has dominated all such campaigns. Based on its comprehensive review of credible sources, Air Wars identified 2003 as the deadliest year of the so-called War on Terror, when a minimum of 5,529 civilians were reported to have been killed by U.S. actions. The next deadliest year was 2017, when at least 4,931 civilians were likely killed, the vast majority in alleged coalition bombing of Iraq and Syria, researchers wrote. However, if we conclude maximum estimates of civilian harm, then 2017 was in fact the worst year for civilian casualties, with up to 19,623 killed. According to Air Wars, 97% of reported civilian death during the so-called War on Terror took place in three countries, including Iraq, Afghanistan, and Syria. Joe Dyke, senior investigator at Air Wars, told Middle East Eye that for much of the last 20 years, people living in Washington or New York could have been forgiven for forgetting their country was at war. Whether a drone strike in a Yemeni village or a military base in rural Afghanistan, it often felt far removed, almost another world. But that isn't how it felt for those millions of people living in those conflicts, Dyke added. Meanwhile, in an email responding to Air Wars' request for official military estimates of civilian casualties in post-9/11 U.S. wars, the Pentagon said that the information review request is not immediately on hand in our offices, as it spans between multiple operations campaigns within a span of between 18 and 20 years.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
We get people. So winners of war.
The Afghanistan war is coming to an end with an embarrassing defeat for the U.S. After over two decades of war and thousands of lives lost, Washington is shamelessly leaving Afghanistan to its devices.
This is a total failure by the United States government. It's a total failure by the commander-in-chief. It's a total failure, really, by the American people, because this is not about the 20-year occupation of Afghanistan. It's about a humanitarian disaster that is unfolding before our eyes that is in part America's making. And I think what you're hearing from veterans is the creation of essentially an underground railroad. We have friends that are over there that are dying right now that we've served with, that we made a moral compact to. We said, we're going to have your back. If you stand up with us, America will have your back.
Hello, I am your host, Daniel Aria. Welcome to We the People, where we take a deep look at U.S. issues. And in this episode, we will ask who really did gain anything from cycles of war in the past 20 years, and what is indeed fueling America's war juggernaut. Stay with us as we try to figure out how the U.S. war mafia is piling up dollars out of regional conflicts elsewhere in the world.
It's long past time we end the forever wars.
Endless, ridiculous foreign wars.
I've long argued that we should bring home the vast majority of our combat troops.
I want to get out of these endless wars. I campaigned on that. I want to get out. We've been in Afghanistan for 19 years.
It's time to end America's longest war.
19 years in Afghanistan. I think that's enough.
With the Taliban back in control of the country, the only winners of America's cool war in Afghanistan appears to be the so-called military-industrial complex and assorted defense contractors. Indeed, America's military-industrial complex makes huge profits from wars it frequently initiates across the world. The military equipment mafia running the United States today has been reaping huge financial gains by fanning the flames of war in every corner of the globe.
There's a reason why we have so many contractors, and that is they are replacing the people who used to wear the uniform who provided what's called combat service support. I was just in Afghanistan 3 weeks ago. If you go into the dining facilities, the cooks, the people who serve you the food, the people who clean up, the people who clean up the place are all contractors. And so the question is this what you want soldiers and sailors and airmen to do, or is this something that you can contract out? And obviously, given that we are going to add some 30,000 people, we need to feed them, we need to house them, we need janitors, we need people to clean the toilets. This is most of what these contractors do.
U.S. presence in resource-rich nations such as Iraq and Afghanistan shows the depth of the military-industrial complex's influence in the first decades of the 21st century. To put this into perspective, we've invited John Caracal to the show. He's an American author, journalist, and former CIA counterterrorism officer. Welcome to the show, John.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Now, what role do you think, John, the corruption in the U.S. military plays in U.S. failure in the war on Afghanistan?
Over the course of my own career at the CIA, I didn't see much in the way of corruption in the Defense Department at the Pentagon, but I certainly did among U.S. defense contractors. These are the defense-related companies to which most military operations, military procurement is contracted out. The big defense contractors that were in charge of things like training the Afghan National Police or training and arming and equipping the Afghan National Army, that's where the real corruption is.
Delving into the 20-year military campaign by the United States and its allies and investigating the true incentive behind the invasion has to replace the mainstream portrayal of war as an attempt to uproot terror cells supposedly masterminding the 9/11 terrorist attacks.
The fact that we sort of went about the evacuation blindly without really considering the possibility of attacks from a group that has attacked girls' schools, that has attacked hospitals, that has attacked all sorts of civilian targets really just perplexes one.
So tell me about that. Is this a failure of the U.S. military in terms of trying to secure that area, or is it a failure of something? What do you think?
Well, much as the 9/11 Commission had concluded nearly two decades ago, it was a deep failure of the imagination. It was certainly a policy failure because there had to be the policy and the contingency planning surrounding such an evacuation at such a rapid pace that then would have been communicated to the military and the military would have executed.
While there are a myriad of reports of the U.S. or the Biden administration's failure in Afghanistan, there's also the story of a successfully executed project from orchestrating the September 11th attacks back in 2001 to withdrawing two decades later in disgrace after having made huge sums of money. and that is the story of defense contractors. Our next guest is David Swanson, author, activist, and journalist, and radio host. He's also the executive director of World Beyond War and campaign coordinator for Roots Action. Thank you, sir, for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Now, how could the situation in Afghanistan today be explained in the context of a project by the U.S. industrial military complex?
Well, you're dealing with a war that was enormously profitable over the past 20 years for some of the biggest corporations in the world and in the United States, some of the biggest funders of the political campaigns of U.S. Congress members and presidents. You now have the biggest five weapons dealers getting five times as much money every year from the U.S. government as before the war. On the stock market, the weapons dealers outperformed the norm by 58%. And this was a war that was planned before September 11th, 2001, that was launched in spite of the willingness of the Taliban to turn bin Laden over to a third country to be put on trial.
The U.S. stated goal of building a functioning civil society has failed disastrously and in total disgrace as foreign forces scramble to evacuate from Kabul airport. Building schools, hospitals, and roads were replaced by endless cycles of violence for at least two decades.
And in an admission that will go down in the annals of intelligence and special operations, some of America's most gifted security professionals tracked down Osama bin Laden after the trail had gone cold.
Joe, what do you think? And I said, you know, I didn't know we had so many economists around the table. I said, we owe the man a direct answer. Mr. President, my suggestion is don't go. We have to do two more things to see if he's there.
The root of the whole withdrawal debacle today is not necessarily just decisions made in the last few weeks or few months, but failures of this so-called nation-building exercise or civilian mission since it began in the Bush era. 20 years of investment and aid by foreign entities collapses as they leave the country in ruins. 20 years of nation-building exercise erased by the Taliban in a matter of weeks. But how does the so-called defense contractors' profits from wars, such as the one in Afghanistan, could be justified?
It's very well known in American politics and in history. Every American high school student knows that in the 1950s, President Eisenhower warned us, he warned all Americans about what he called the military-industrial complex. He had originally called it the military-industrial congressional complex, and he warned us that there was no oversight of these military and defense contractors, that they would do anything to make money, including to prolong wars. And they've done that all through modern American history, from the early days of the Vietnam War until today in Afghanistan.
So many of the projects that foreign forces and NGOs left behind have collapsed. And one American keepsake which captures the spirit of the U.S. failure is the readiness of Afghan forces who are trained by the U.S. and its allies. Afghan forces' defeat or defection to the Taliban surprised the American and other foreign military commanders.
There are Afghan civilians who support the withdrawal of U.S. forces because they see them as occupiers. But for politicians leading the frontline fight against the Taliban, like Hamdullah Mohib, it brings complications. Mohib is the National Security Advisor for Afghanistan, and he's come to Helmand to meet with security officials.
So in what way has the U.S. withdrawal impacted your job as National Security Advisor?
Well, we weren't expecting it to come this soon. So there hasn't really been a proper transition. It has helped in one way, but also put us at risk in others. We had to expedite self-reliance and self-sufficiency with our security forces at a much faster pace than what we were preparing for.
And the risk?
The Taliban could see this as an opportunity.
U.S. military and political leaders have on several occasions asserted that they were taken by surprise and startled by the speed with which the Taliban took over Afghanistan. the lack of preparedness by Afghan military forces, their unwillingness to fight, and the rapid pace of Afghan government collapse was also unexpected, according to administration officials. So what is next for war hawks after the U.S. manages to fully withdraw from Afghanistan?
There seems to have been established during the course of this war the idea that bombing a country is perfectly normal and legal and not to be even noticed, much less considered part of a war. There is the possibility that the U.S. And others in Afghanistan will start up a new war, backing new warlords against the Taliban. There is also the possibility that the United States will shift to backing and arming directly and openly and formally arming the Taliban. In any case, there is endless talk about moving on to other wars.
Corruption runs rampant in the U.S. political and economic landscape at federal, state, and private levels. The Americans brought corruption and graft to Afghanistan as an integral part of their aid. Corruption by foreign entities in Afghanistan played a major role in the destruction and handover of the country to the Taliban. The Americans clinched a deal with the Taliban in 2020 under the former Donald Trump administration and decided to cut and run.
This agreement will mean nothing, and today's good feelings will not last if we don't take concrete actions on commitments and promises that have been made. When it comes down to it, the future of Afghanistan is for Afghans to determine. The U.S. Taliban deal creates the conditions for Afghans to do just that. Here's our take on what steps by the Taliban will make this agreement a success. First, keep your promises to cut ties with Al-Qaeda and other terrorists. Keep up the fight to defeat ISIS.
U.S. intelligence agencies have often fallen behind in capturing a comprehensive image of complicated conflicts in Afghanistan. And that's why the Taliban could ultimately gain the upper hand and overrun the country in just a matter of days. U.S. spy agencies indeed failed to realize the complexity of the situation and kept giving false reports to the commander-in-chief, hence the U.S. president.
There were competing interests, very powerful competing interests in Afghanistan for the United States over the last 20 years. You had, for example, the political end, which was to impose a Western-style democracy on Afghanistan, which is a country that never had any history of a Western-style democracy. But then you have the military. The military was charged with nation building, which is never a good idea. And nation building had been tried in Afghanistan in the past, and it had failed. And then you had the defense contractors, these big companies like Northrop Grumman or Teledyne or any number, really, of them here in the United States. There are so many in the Washington area, you almost can't keep them straight. Their goal was to drag this war, this occupation, out as long as possible.
Since the invasion kicked off in the Bush administration, U.S. approach towards Afghanistan has been handled by multiple administrations, all of which had vowed to pull back American forces and military equipment from the war-ravaged country.
He surrendered our air base, he surrendered our weapons, he surrendered our embassy. They spent $1 billion building this ridiculous embassy, and he abandoned our great American citizens. They're over right now. They have no idea. Remember this, the Taliban's tough, and they don't respect our country, and they don't respect our president. It's not good. They're over there now, and they don't know what's going to happen, our citizens. Joe Biden was going on vacation as Afghanistan was going to hell. And this is what you get when you have weakness in the White House. You can't have weakness in the White House. They have to respect your president. When I was president, we only had strength.
From President Obama, who inherited the war, to President Trump, who promoted the GOP's policy of bringing soldiers back home, today President Biden is getting the job done at great cost for Afghans. As the profitable Afghanistan project comes to an end, military investors of the U.S. seek new grounds to pile up blood dollars.
There is no such thing as a defense contractor. There are departments that we have to call defense because that's their official name. But the vast bulk of what the U.S. military does and spends money on has no conceivable defensive purpose. None of it is used defensively. The war has generated enemies and hostility. There was a study recently, you can find it at Peace Science Digest, that found that in proportion to each nation around the world sending troops as a NATO member and ally to take part in the war on Afghanistan, they generated terrorism against their own country. Same with the United States. It endangered itself.
With U.S. outsourcing its wars, failure seems to be just around the corner at the end of every military-industrial project. Afghanistan's case is no exception, in that the United States is a definitive loser. With decades of invasive experiments from Vietnam to Afghanistan, the U.S. defense forces have been on the losing side at the end of every war.
It was shocking how quick it turned, how quick it collapsed. I mean, it went up like a Roman candle. This is a horrible defeat for America, and it's going to haunt us for years to come. I would, what we need now is strength and confidence in our leaders, and we're not getting that right now. It's kind of chaos behind the scenes, and everybody knows it. We're here because of people decided to take the easy wrong over the hard right.
The emotions are all even more so. When I wrote the tweet on Saturday, it was as I said on the tweet, it was my bangiversary. It was my anniversary and blown up. I just felt on Saturday I had to write something. I had to put my two pence in. Just seeing events unfold in Afghanistan, just heartbreaking and devastating to see.
For the military-industrial complex, each regional conflict is a potential business opportunity, regardless of bloodshed and insecurity that could affect multiple generations. How does the U.S. military devise its strategies exactly in view of the experiments such as Vietnam and Afghanistan?
It's really not up to the U.S. military to decide military operations. We have civilian leadership of the Defense Department and civilian oversight on Capitol Hill. The military in the United States goes where it's told to go, when it's told to go, by policymakers. And so really, this falls on whoever happens to be president. I think we've learned some valuable lessons, the most important of which is that nation building does not work, and it should not be the responsibility of the United States to decide what countries should and should not be advanced, and what countries should and should not be occupied.
Now, money has been lost all along the foreign mission in Afghanistan. One example, the $7.8 billion that the U.S. State Department spent in Afghanistan since 2008. According to official SIGAR reports, that's the leading U.S. government oversight office known as the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, only $1.2 billion were actually spent there, and the rest is all gone.
In 1961, President Eisenhower gave a farewell speech in which he warned the nation about what he called the military-industrial complex. It sounds scary, like something out of a conspiracy theory or a sci-fi movie. But what exactly was President Eisenhower afraid of? What is the military-industrial complex? It refers to the close relationship between military leaders, government legislators, bureaucrats, and private contractors, all of whom have a stake in national defense. Under our current system, the U.S. government has a monopoly on defense at the national level, meaning that they're the only provider of defense to U.S. citizens. You can't start a private army to compete with it. But that doesn't mean private companies aren't involved. The government purchases military equipment and services from private firms, including uniforms, vehicles, weapons, and more.
Afghanistan is neither the beginning nor the end of projects by the U.S. military-industrial complex. The so-called defense contractors are evacuating hastily today, only to head for more profitable projects elsewhere in the world. All they care about is money, made out of conflicts across the globe, whenever the U.S. government is ready to invest.
Certainly there has been enormous corruption. There has been corruption in terms of funneling funding to the Taliban while fighting it. There has been corruption in terms of installing a puppet government that was not answerable to the people of Afghanistan. There has been corruption in covering up the atrocities of the war and lying to allies and to the U.S. Congress and to the U.S. public. There has been very little about the war, as with most wars, that was not corrupt.
The U.S. promise of a non-corrupt democracy was only a lie, as Afghanistan would acknowledge in the streets of the capital, Kabul, and other major cities in the hands of the Taliban today. Legalized corruption caused by the way U.S. contracting system works, or the genuine corruption that they fail to root out in the country, are resulting in the victimization of Afghans on the streets or those thousands of miles away from home.
I never planned that I go escape like this and come for as a refugee here. It was really hard for me, not only for me, the those women's children that I saw them. Still, when I want to rest or sleep, I couldn't like forget those moments, those like images, the dead bodies, the shots, the gases, and especially the aggressive behavior of Taliban with people in Afghanistan.
The U.S. initially funded Taliban to take on the Soviets and then made the decision to remove them from power, only to see them emerge again after 20 years.
Militarism does not work. The evidence is very clear that non-violent tools and movements accomplish more and better than anything violence can. And we need the money that is being dumped into militarism for actual human and environmental needs. We need to undo the damage that militarism does to our cultures, to international relations, to international institutions, to racism and bigotry, and we need to put the money into something useful.
As the modern-day colonization of resource-rich nations continues, people in Afghanistan remain disillusioned by the so-called nation-building exercises and civilian missions led by U.S. military, and the bloodshed that it inevitably causes.
A tough day. This evening in Kabul, as you all know, terrorist attack that we've been talking about, and worried about, that the intelligence community has assessed, has undertaken an attack by a group known as ISIS-K. Took the lives of American service members.
Afghans now join a multitude of nations with a living experience of lies and atrocities yielded by the world powers' military campaigns into lands which do not belong to them. Repercussions of U.S. adventurism are sadly here to stay for generations to come in Afghanistan. Well, thank you, everyone. I'm your host, Daniel Arya. Be sure to tune in next week when we return with another episode of We the People. Goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.